Welcome to the UUSM Connections podcast. I'm Jack Brennan, UUSM Connections. If you are a regular listener, then you know what comes next. I'm going to introduce our guest, but not today. For today and next week, the first two Sundays of Pride Month, we are going to do something different. We have two Pride episodes. Today's episode is about the legal history of marriage equality, and I'll tell you more about next week's episode at the end of this one. Marriage equality is not something that started in 2015 when we got the Obergefell decision from the Supreme Court. There was a lot that led up to that point, and that's what we're going to be talking about today, relative mostly to the Supreme Court. In Griswold versus Connecticut, which is a 1965 case, the issue was not, of course, about same-sex marriage. It's a case about the right to privacy and access to contraception. Griswold was the head of Planned Parenthood in Connecticut, and she was convicted of violating a law that criminalized the use of any drug or device to prevent conception. It also criminalized assisting someone else in obtaining contraception. And in that case, the Supreme Court decided that that law violated the sanctity of marriage and could not be used in cases involving married couples. And this was in 1965. So single women in Connecticut could still not legally use contraception, but married people could because of this privacy violation that the Supreme Court found. In Griswold, the court said that the right to marry is a fundamental liberty. They said marriage is older than the Bill of Rights, our political parties, and our school system. Marriage is an association that promotes a way of life, not causes, a harmony in living, not political faiths, and a bilateral loyalty, not commercial or social projects. As I said, this isn't a marriage equality case, but it's a good case upon which marriage equality litigation would rely later because of its holding about the right to marry being a fundamental liberty and the legal rights that are attached to marriage. The next case was 2 years later, and again, not a same-sex marriage case, but still a useful case in the fight that would come later. This is called Loving versus Virginia, and of all the Supreme Court cases that I'll be talking about today, this might be the one that you've heard about because there have been documentaries and movies about it. Virginia had a law that banned interracial marriage. Mildred Jeter was Black, her husband Richard Loving was white. They got married in Washington, D.C. When they returned to Virginia, where both of their families lived, they were arrested. The judge in that case said, this is a quote, "Almighty God created the races white, black, yellow, Malay, and red, and he placed them upon separate continents. The fact that he separated the races shows that he did not intend for the races to mix." The Lovings were sentenced to a year in prison, but the judge suspended the sentence if they would agree to leave the state for 25 years. I'm not sure what that was supposed to accomplish, but that was the deal. So the Lovings left the state. But when they returned to visit their family 5 years later, they were arrested for traveling together. Inspired by the civil rights movement, Mildred wrote to then Attorney General Robert Kennedy, who sent the case to the ACLU. What the Supreme Court ended up holding was that Virginia had violated the Due Process Clause by having this law. The court said, "Marriage is a basic civil right, fundamental to our very existence and survival. To deny this fundamental freedom on so unsupportable a basis as racial classifications is so directly subversive to the principle of equality at the heart of the 14th Amendment that it surely deprives citizens of liberty without due process of law." The arguments against interracial marriage were the same ones that were used 10 years ago in same-sex marriage cases. God, and what about the children? In 1986, we had the Georgia case of Bowers v. Hardwick. Police were in Mike Hardwick's home to arrest him on a failure to appear warrant in a public drinking case, and they discovered him having sex with another man. He was arrested under Georgia's anti-sodomy statute. Hardwick was found guilty, but that was overturned on appeal. Georgia then appealed to the Supreme Court of the United States. The Supreme Court said that the U.S. Constitution did not confer a fundamental right to engage in homosexual sodomy. This is a quote from the case. "While the right to privacy protects intimate aspects of marriage, procreation, contraception, and child rearing from state interference, it does not protect gay sodomy because," and I quote again, "no connection between family, marriage, or procreation on the one hand and homosexual activity on the other has been demonstrated." In 1996, there was the case of Romer v. Evans. Colorado voters amended their constitution to preclude any law designed to protect persons from discrimination based on their homosexual, lesbian, or bisexual orientation, conduct, practices, or relationships. Following a legal challenge, the state trial court entered a permanent injunction enjoining Amendment 2's enforcement, and the state Supreme Court affirmed that. Justice Kennedy wrote the Supreme Court opinion on this Romer case. He said that the Supreme Court sometimes allows a law that might disadvantage a certain group of people as long as it furthers a legitimate government interest. But here's the quote. "If the constitutional conception of equal protection of the law means anything, it must at the very least mean a bare desire to harm a politically unpopular group cannot constitute a legitimate government interest." Then we got the Defense of Marriage Act, sometimes called DOMA. It was enacted in 1996. Bill Clinton was the president who signed this into law. It said that no state would be required to give full faith and credit to a same-sex marriage that was legally performed in another state. So what does full faith and credit mean? That's a phrase that means that what happens in one state is recognized by other states. So if I get married in Texas and I move to California, for example, my marriage would be recognized in California. But for same-sex marriage, DOMA wants to make it clear that if I get married in a state that allows same-sex marriage, like I get married in Maine, and then I move to Texas, Texas does not have to recognize that I am married. And I will not be married in the eyes of the federal government either. So even though I am married legally in Maine, I still get no benefit that I might otherwise be entitled to in an opposite sex marriage from the federal government. It said that the federal government would not recognize legal same-sex marriages because this federal law was defining marriage as only between a man and a woman. Then we had the case of Lawrence v. Texas. This was a case that originated in Houston when police entered the home of John Lawrence and found him engaged in sex with another man in violation of Texas's sodomy law. Unlike the law in Georgia that we heard about a moment ago, the Texas law applied only to homosexuals and not to heterosexuals. What that meant was that heterosexuals could engage in sodomy all the time and it was fine. But homosexuals, nope, you could be arrested. And according to Bowers v. Hardwick, that Georgia case, that unequal protection was fine. That was fine. But Lawrence v. Texas changed that. The Supreme Court overturned Bowers v. Hardwick, and at the same time, they overturned every sodomy law in the country. And that included quite a few sodomy laws. In Lawrence v. Texas, the Supreme Court said, adults may choose to enter upon an intimate relationship in the confines of their home and their own private lives and still retain their dignity as free persons. They said, when sexuality finds overt expression in intimate conduct with another person, the conduct can be but one element in a personal bond that is more enduring. The liberty protected by the Constitution allows homosexual persons the right to make this choice. This was a really big case. Then the next big case, which you will probably remember if you were in California, especially in 2013 and before when this case actually started. But in 2013, the case of Hollingsworth v. Perry came before the Supreme Court. This was a very controversial case about same-sex marriage. In the Perry case, the Supreme Court actually sidestepped making a decision about whether the Constitution provides a right for same-sex couples to marry. This case was about Proposition 8 in California. Prop 8 had been decided by voters. Voters in California voted on whether to ban same-sex marriage in the state of California. And they voted to ban it. The federal district court where the case was filed overturned Prop 8 And although the state could have appealed that ruling, it didn't because the state government didn't like Proposition 8 to begin with. So a group of people who were against marriage equality stepped in to defend Proposition 8 by appealing the ruling of the trial court to overturn Prop 8. The Court of Appeals affirmed the trial court's decision to overturn Prop 8, and then Prop 8 defenders appealed their decision to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court held that the group who stepped in to defend Proposition 8 did not have standing in the case. What does that mean? Why didn't they have standing? Standing means that you have to have an interest in the case and not like, oh, I'm interested in that case. Not that kind of interest. But you have to have a financial interest or what is called a pecuniary interest in the outcome. You have a stake in the outcome of the case. They said this group was not going to be affected by same-sex marriage. No one was going to force them to have a same-sex marriage. They didn't have standing because they lacked the elements of standing to make a case. If the Prop 8 defenders had no standing to appeal the case in the first place, that meant that the Court of Appeals decision was vacated and the decision of the trial court to overturn Prop 8 stood. And same-sex marriage licenses began to be issued by the state of California within 24 hours of that ruling. Another case was decided on that same day. And it was called United States versus Windsor. Edith Windsor and Thea Speier, same-sex couple living in New York, were lawfully married in Canada in 2007. Thea Speier died in 2009, leaving her entire estate to Edith Windsor. Windsor wanted to claim the federal estate tax exemption for surviving spouses, but was barred from doing so by the Defense of Marriage Act, which said that the term spouse applied only to marriages between a man and a woman. The IRS found that the estate tax exemption did not apply to same-sex marriages, so it denied Windsor's claim and compelled her to pay $363,000 in estate taxes. Windsor filed suit seeking a refund because the Defense of Marriage Act singled out legally married same-sex couples for differential treatment compared to other similarly situated married couples without any justification. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder agreed that the Defense of Marriage Act violated the U.S. Constitution and said he would no longer defend that law in court. The bipartisan legal advisory group defended the law in court. In U.S. versus Windsor, the Supreme Court said that Section 3 of the Defense of Marriage Act is unconstitutional as a deprivation of the liberty of the person protected by the Fifth Amendment. The court held 5-4 that the Constitution prevented the federal government from treating state-sanctioned heterosexual marriages differently than state-sanctioned homosexual marriages. And that such differentiation demeaned the couple whose moral and sexual choices the Constitution protects. After the Windsor decision, the federal government determined that all of the federal benefits of marriage would extend to same-sex couples who were legally married in any state, even if they lived in a state that doesn't recognize same-sex marriage. That included IRS benefits, Social Security, and VA benefits. There was a big push after Windsor to put same-sex marriage on the ballot in different states. Some states had already done that, and more states wanted to do it. But we don't really vote on civil rights, right? I mean, in 1920, if we had taken a vote on whether to give women the right to vote, would women have gotten the right to vote? And if we had put the Civil Rights Act of 1964 on state ballots, how many states would have approved the Civil Rights Act of 1964? I can think of a pretty good list of them that would not have approved that. Justice Kennedy wrote, "The dynamic of our constitutional system is that individuals need not await legislative action before asserting a fundamental right. The nation's courts are opened to individuals who come to them to vindicate their own direct personal stake in our basic charter. An individual can invoke a right to constitutional protection when he or she is harmed, even if the broader public disagrees and even if the legislature refuses to act." This next quote is from an old case, like before I was born, a 1943 case called West Virginia Board of Education v. Barnett. Of course, not a marriage case at all. But this quote is important from that case. "The idea of the Constitution was to withdraw certain subjects from the vicissitudes of political controversy, to place them beyond the reach of majorities and officials, and to establish them as legal principles to be applied by the courts. This is why fundamental rights may not be submitted to a vote. They depend on no election outcome." And that was part of the case that changed everything. The Supreme Court decided on June 26, 2015, and I was in the Supreme Court when this was announced, the case of Obergefell versus Hodges. This case involved a same-sex couple, John and James, who were married in a state where it was legal to marry someone of the same sex. Living in Ohio, a state where same-sex marriage was not legal, John was dying, and they both wanted James to be listed on the death certificate as a surviving spouse. The local registrar agreed that a death certificate should list his spouse as surviving spouse, even though same-sex marriage was not allowed in Ohio. But then the Ohio Attorney General found out, and he said he would go to court to defend Ohio's same-sex marriage ban. And it all ended up at the Supreme Court in a 5-4 decision. The Supreme Court decided that the 14th Amendment is violated when same-sex couples are denied the right to marry, and that all states must recognize and give full faith and credit to same-sex marriages that are granted in other states. From the opinion of the court written by Justice Kennedy, it says, No union is more profound than marriage, for it embodies the highest ideals of love, fidelity, devotion, sacrifice, and family. In forming a marital union, two people become something greater than once they were. It goes on to say, it would misunderstand these men and women to say they disrespect the idea of marriage. Their plea is that they do respect it so deeply that they seek to find its fulfillment for themselves. They ask for equal dignity in the eyes of the law. The Constitution grants them that right. That was 2015. It has been 8 years since that decision. Could same-sex couples lose the right to marriage equality? Justice Alito mentioned that in a case not long ago, the case of Dobbs that overturned Roe v. Wade. This was a 5-4 decision, and it's not at all clear that it would still be that if the Supreme Court were to decide that case today. I hope you will join us next week when we'll be looking at how Obergefell and other Supreme Court cases have fueled the assault on trans rights in state legislatures across the country. Keep making connections.